Good evening and welcome. Welcome to something that I enjoy very much, talking about myself. My name is Cliff, and I am the alcoholic. I'm very proud and honored to have been invited to share my story with my peers in recovery, especially here at my home group in Sobrenity. It's a bit different in many ways and contains many outside issues brought about by my alcoholic behavior. If I exclude these critical points of my story, it will leave you with more questions than answers. So I hope that you will bear with me and hear what I have to say, okay? So after last night's meeting, I love to open up with laughter. It's just something I do. After last night's meeting, we went to this Mexican restaurant down the street to have all-you-can-eat tacos. A table of about 18 men on one side and a table of about 18 women on the other side. It's just something we do after the meeting. So I'm sitting at the end of the table, and Doug M. walks up to me in front of everybody and says, "So, Cliff, is this your first time?" My God, it has been ages since a man has asked me that. Woo, Lord, I loved it. So I got quite a few laughs out of that. It was really great, though. So, miraculously, I'm 50 years old, standing here alive before you today. It's just an incredible feeling. And I'm overwhelmed with gratitude at the number of people who came out to support me. God sent me a true blessing. Thank you all for being here. And much thanks to all the work and special preparation that went in for tonight's banquet. It was just an incredible amount of work that everybody put in to make this night special for me, too. Thank you. All right. What it was like, what happened, and what I am like now. I'm from San Antonio, Texas. That's where I hail from. And I grew up in a little small mobile home community on the suburbs of San Antonio, Texas, very small town called Cibolo, population of about 400. And it was a really small place, and I was very different from the time I was a little child. I had a great childhood. My father was an Air Force, my father's an Air Force veteran, or was, he's passed away, and he was the world to me. He used to come home every day in his dress blues, just looking all sharp, and I was so proud to look at my father. He was so tall, and he was just so driven, and he's so handsome, good provider. And I have one younger sister and one older brother. And I was stamped an alcoholic from the time that I was 2 years old. And the only reason that I know that is because it's a favorite story of my family, brought about every Christmas when we all got together for our family reunions. Story has it that in 1969, on New Year's Eve, my family had a New Year's Eve party. And they liked Jim Beam and Coke. Everybody in Texas drinks Jim Beam and Coke, if not Jack and Coke. But Jim Beam was the big one in my family. And there's about 60 people in the party. Well, after the party broke up, Mom put me to bed in my crib, and the crowd dispersed, and they went off to bed. And some noise in the middle of the night had awoken my mother. And she came out into the living room to find me on the floor in a pool of vomit. It was just terrible. I'm a little baby, 2 years old. Well, Mom, of course, she's still quite buzzed, as was my father from the party, and she's panicking, screaming. And she's like, "Bob, wake up, wake up. Something wrong with him, something wrong with him." So they came out and they found me, or they picked me up out of the floor, and I was just lifeless, basically lifeless. And my mom says, "We got to get him to the hospital." So they drove me to the military base hospital at Randolph Air Force Base, and surprisingly, they get past security. They're both just drunk as a skunk, carrying this near-dead child to the hospital, right? Now, in this day and age, if that sort of thing happened, some people would be spending a lot of time in jail. But in 1969, let's face it, if you didn't get your kid drunk, it would be an event, right? So they get me to the hospital, and my mom's like, "Doctor, is he going to die? He's so sick, I don't know what's wrong with him." The doctor looked at my mom and said, "This kid ain't sick. He's drunk. He needs to go home and sleep this thing off." So my parents took me back home. Of course, no arrests, no DUIs, nothing like that. Because, again, in 1969, it's just not that big of a deal. You know, everybody drives drunk or whatever, without seatbelts and without child restraints and all the rules and restrictions that we have today. So, yeah, that was a favorite story among Christmas events at my house. about me being drunk at 2 years old. Good Lord, I was stamped an alcoholic from the very beginning. So growing up, I always knew that I was different from all the other children in the neighborhood. Couldn't quite pin it down why. Didn't understand what was going on with me. But naturally, I liked playing with the girls in the neighborhood more than the boys. I liked learning how to twirl batons, playing with the little girl across the street with her little china tea set and her little tree house, play with dolls and stuff like that. And it seemed to me that most of the adults in the world knew what was going on with me, but nobody told me. And you just don't speak about that in my family because, you know, when your father is an Air Force veteran and you're living in Texas in the 60s and the early 70s, that's just not something that you talk about in the neighborhood, you know. So so I had a pretty rough childhood. A lot of the kids picked at me, and I was alienated by, you know, all of the, quote, normal people in the neighborhood, and I didn't have much of a life. So I isolated a lot as a child, and I studied science, and I was just basically a nerd, you know. I loved all those little explorations out in the woods and stuff like that. So I spent a lot of time alone. But my feelings were developing, and I didn't quite know how to stop it. It was really strange for me, but as I went to church on Sundays and stuff, you know, we always learned that people like me were abominations, that, you know, there was a demon inside of me and that it needed to be cast out. Otherwise, you know, if you're going to go to hell, you've got to change and da-da-da-da-da. And they advised my parents about things like that, but instead of nurturing and trying to figure out what to do about that sort of thing, they lashed out at me because I was, quote, a freak. It was just terrible. So I was even alienated by my parents, you know. Because my mom married at 14 years old, and she didn't know anything about that sort of thing. She's from an even smaller town in Arkansas, so she'd never been faced with anything like that before. And there was nobody else in the neighborhood like that, nor in my school. And I have a pretty strong gaydar. Now, this is not all a coming-out story. This is what this is. This is the things that led up to the development of an alcoholic, right? Because I isolated from a very young age. And my father, after he retired from the military, he's used to working, a hard-working man. He was 22 years in the Air Force, and he worked every day of his life, really hard-working man. But after he retired, he found himself without a lot of things to do except sit around the house and watch football games, stuff like that. Naturally, that's going to get boring after a period of time. So he started hanging around with this little pool hall up the street. It was a gas station converted into a little nightclub called Cibolo Self-Serve. Yeah, back then when you did self-service gasoline, who remembers that, right? So he used to hang out there every day, made a lot of friends and stuff, and he'd come home drunk quite a bit. Well, there was something about my father. Forgive me, Father, I'll get back to the good stuff about him. But something about my father when he drank alcohol, something crossed over inside him. And as we're all familiar with some people who are like this, he became angry. He became angry and violent. And he was, like I said, a veteran of the Vietnam War, so he had a lot of traumatic issues in his head and stuff. And dealing with a kid like me, and then my older brother, who was a diehard redneck, thought he was Bo Duke from the Dukes of Hazzard, right? I swear he wore a 10-gallon hat. The hat was bigger than our house. It was so huge. I was like, Lord, have mercy. And he always picked at me because, you know, all the kids in the neighborhood would, like, make fun of him because of his little brother. So I felt responsible for a lot of bad things that were going on in my family. So, again, I was even alienated by my brother. And my little sister became my world to me. She and I wound up spending a lot of time together because, you know, she cared about me. She loved me very much. And for some strange reason, she just seemed to naturally be nurturing and understanding or whatever. But we still never talked about it. So, my desperate need for attention and my desperate need for friends drove me to do a lot of crazy things. Like kids would dare me to do certain things when I was a child just to see if I would do it because they were really exploiting me. But I was so desperate for friendship that I'd do whatever they told me to. So one time they dared me to break into somebody's house. It was this old man, Mr. Hoffman, that lived in a trailer right down the street from us. And he used to pass out candy to the kids in the neighborhood. So they dared me to break into his house and steal the candy dish. So I did. And broke through the little screen glass window on his door and went inside while he was sleeping. The man's like 85 years old. Really old man. Sweet, sweet guy. But I broke into his house and I stole the candy dish. And the kids were like, yeah, that's really awesome, you know. But after a period of time, the brouhaha about that sort of died out. And I felt like, oh, shit, they're getting away from me again. What am I going to do? I got to get them back. So I started breaking into other people's houses. But I never stole anything. I just broke in while they were sleeping, and I rearranged their furniture. Because I thought that was about the most creative thing I can do, because I didn't want to steal anything from anybody, but I really wanted to see some shock on their faces. And so soon, all the kids in the neighborhood were like, yeah, go Cliff, you know. So, man, I saw it in a movie one time where a kid had broke into his professor's office and took all of the furniture out of the office and set it up on the school campus. I think the movie was called School Ties. Really cool movie. And when the professor came out the next day and found his entire office out on the grounds, it was just hell on the boys. So it gave me the idea to do that, and it was really, really funny. So I did stuff like that growing up. Always stayed in trouble. Always got in trouble in school. And my father, as I'd said, addicted to work, eventually needed to find work. So he decided to take on a job as a custodian for the very school district that I was going to, the Schertz-Cibolo Universal City Independent School District. He was a custodian, a head custodian for the school district. So I couldn't do shit in school without my dad knowing about it, right? But I had already gotten myself into a lot of trouble. I was stealing things out of lockers, and I was doing all kinds of stuff to get in trouble at school. And every time I would do something, immediate phone call went straight to my father. My father, embarrassed about my behavior, tore me a new one when I got home. It was terrible. So I really can't say a lot of bad things about my father, because I wasn't such a good kid. I caused a lot of my own problems. But that's what home life was like for years. And all through this time, I'm developing this psycho behavior about what's natural to me, but unnatural to everybody else. And, you know, I'm dealing with a lot of that. And I think I have, let me just get down to it. I think I have a pretty good gaydar, right? I can tell, you know, with people. But I can honestly look back at my past in my school, and I cannot think of a living soul who might even possibly have been like me. So I felt like the only one in the world. And I was like, I prayed and I cried to God, help me, what's going on? Take care of this Lord. I prayed for help from a God that would never come, because I did not know at the time that it's just natural to some people. I was always told by other people that it was abomination, that was hell bent, whatever. So that's how I went through high school. I had a lot of difficulties, church influence, shame, school failing. And then by the time I moved out of that small town, I moved to San Antonio. San Antonio is a much bigger city. It's a really nice little place, too. So I met my first boyfriend. His name was Joe Cosby. And he was a drug addict, but he was an intravenous drug addict. Now, I had heard about these terrifying things in school or whatever, but I was so overjoyed and happy to have met another person that had something in common with me that I was willing to overlook that. I remember watching him stick needles in his arms and inject crank into his system and stuff. But, you know, it just didn't affect me. I was like, wow, whatever, you know. I was just really comfortable being around somebody that was like me. So that was my first experience with all of that stuff. And I finally fit in with some other people. I met some of his friends, and maybe seven or eight people, and I thought, wow, there's this secret society. We've got a group of people that nobody else knows about, and I finally have somebody I can relate to. I still don't know that there's others on the outside. I figured this is a small group. Why don't we just start a club, right? So I was so involved in all of that chaos. So after a couple of years of that and still getting influences from the people in church, I decided to call my Aunt Ruby, who lives in Winchester, Tennessee. It's right outside of Mount Eagle Mountain. Everything but the snake venom with the churches out there, I'll tell you. And there probably is that, too. So she said, yeah, come on down, fly to Nashville. I'd never gotten on a plane before. I took everything I owned, and I boarded a Southwest Airlines flight, and I flew to Nashville. First time ever on a plane, but that was exciting. But I left everything I owned except a little bag of clothes behind. Everything I collected as a child, my high school annuals, my pictures of my family, everything that I ever owned was left behind. And I flew to Nashville, where my aunt picked me up. And I spent the next 2 years, I was 19, spent the next 2 years in Winchester, and I was diving into the book, into the Holy Bible. And I was very highly spirited, and I got to know that book quite well, and I was living great and feeling great. And then a couple of years later, my cousin came up from Chattanooga, and he's like, you know, there's really not much in this small town for Cliff. Why don't I take him back to Chattanooga with me, and we can see about getting him a job and getting him started out there. Alcohol's coming, trust, very shortly. So I moved from Winchester to Chattanooga when I was 20 years old, almost 21. And I thought to myself, okay, all that gay shit's behind me. It's gone. I don't have to worry about it anymore. I can start my whole life. Everything is behind me. Came to Chattanooga. Oh, my God. It was like somebody opened up the doors of hell. They were everywhere. Like, where the hell all these people come from, you know? So I got a job at a Pizza Hut where I met these two girls, and they were like, you know, your 21st birthday's coming up. Why don't you come out to the bar with us? Well, it didn't click what she's talking about. But so I got, you know, on my 21st birthday, I went to this little place called Allen's on Macaulay Avenue in Chattanooga. Very nice place, and it was a gay bar. And when I got inside there, I was like, well, you know, no aunts, no uncles, nobody that knows me, so, you know, I'm cool or whatever. But there were people all over the place. The whole place was packed with people on a Saturday night. And I thought, there are people just like me. Okay, I can handle this. But I can't talk to anybody because I'm terrified. Well, at one point, somebody came up and offered to buy me a drink. Naturally, my heart almost jumped out of my chest because somebody said, hey, I went, So, nervous, terrified, yeah, I took the drink. Chop. It was a Long Island iced tea, and they make them strong in that club. So I felt that warm sensation go down my esophagus, and I was like, wow, it's cool. After a few sips of that, since I wasn't a heavy drinker, in fact, I wasn't hardly a drinker all the time, I caught kind of a little bit of a buzz, and after a few drinks, my guard was let down, and I felt comfortable, and I started talking to a few people. And, you know, I was like, wow, this shit's powerful, right? So I go back and get more. Well, I learned that they sell Long Island tea by the pitchers there. So instead of just ordering a drink, I thought, well, instead of going back and forth, I'll just get a pitcher. So the pitchers went down as fast as the individual drinks, because the more I drank, the more I talked, and the more fun I had. And it was just so easy for me to associate with these people. So I spent like almost 7 days a week going back to that club, because I was finally in a place again where I fit in and nobody was judging me. I didn't have any family pressuring me, so I could do that, whatever. And I drank a lot of alcohol. And again, still, now that I've got this courage built up inside me in the liquid form, I'm trying to be the center of attention again in another way. So I'm like, wow, okay, this is going to be cool. So, you know, I'm getting around and I'm just walking up and meeting people and doing shit I've never done before, you know. I'm talking to strangers and I'm talking about things that I've never had any experience with, but I felt good. And then the dance floor clears out, the lights in the club go down, and this spotlight hits the stage, right? So I'm like, Johnny, what's going on here? He goes, oh, you don't know about this? And I was like, no, he said, this is a drag show. And I was like, well, I don't know what he's talking about, because the drag shows I went to in Texas were tractor pulls, right? I've been to many tractor pulls, you know, drag racing, drag shows and all this. So I'm like, okay, cool. So, you know, everybody lines up around the stage and stuff, and the light comes on, and here comes this really tall, glamorous entertainer doing this rock and roll number in this awesome costume. I'm still not piecing together what I'm looking at. But everybody is screaming and tossing money at her and all this stuff. And I'm sitting there going, wow, that is so awesome. That is so cool. And Johnny looks at me and he goes, you know, they have an amateur night. And I was like, amateur what? So he says, they have an amateur night for performers. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? He says, Cliff, do you not realize that's a guy up there? I was like, you're kidding me. No way, no way. This is how naive I am at 21 years old, right? I mean, people usually know by the time they're 13 nowadays. But so I was very intrigued by that, and I used to go and watch the drag shows all the time, and it was really cool. And I kept looking at that, like, little Ariel from The Little Mermaid, you know? I want to be part of that world. Just staring at that stage going, God, I so want to be up there, because that's the center of attention. That's like the ultimate peak of everything I've ever wanted. So I decided that I was going to do this, right? So I went to a thrift shop trying to find something to wear. You can't find anything to wear on stage at a thrift shop, but I had to learn that the hard way. So I went to a thrift shop, and I found this hoop skirt that goes underneath one of those Southern Belle ball gowns. And I thought, well, I'll just glue some sequins and some ribbon on it and do whatever. So I made this little crop top and this hoop skirt thing with my midriff showing. And I went out there and did the song Like a Virgin by Madonna. Little did I realize that in the near future, the only thing this girl was ever going to do like a virgin is have a baby in a stable. By an unknown father. No, but in truth, it was really fun. I was booger. I was completely booger. It was terrible. But I didn't care. I looked terrible. My makeup was horrible. My wig was terrible. But I did it all by myself. And I was out there in the middle of the stage, center of attention. And it just felt like I was on top of the world. I was oblivious to how terrible I was. But I didn't win the talent night that night because there was like six other contestants. So I was desperate to do it again. And I did it again. And I did it again. And again. Long time went by. And I thought to myself, you know, well, Dollar General and Family Dollar clothing just doesn't seem to be getting it on this stage. So I'm going to have to come up with something because they're wearing, back in the 80s, that sequins were considered formal wear. Nowadays, it's just like normal attire. But it was formal wear and stuff, and the stuff is very expensive, and I couldn't afford it. So I would buy, let's say, like a polka-dotted fabric with a pack of sequins, and I would glue sequins all over the polka dots so I could make instant sequin fabric. And started getting better, and I got it into my head, I've got to do something crazy outrageous. Meanwhile, I'm drinking this whole time, right? By the way, yeah, I got to remember that alcoholism is what we're talking about. Before I go on stage every time, I've got to catch a really good buzz because, you know, that's when I really bring it is when I've got a good buzz on, right? I just have no fear of anything when I'm drunk, you know. Wow, you know. So I'm walking down Macaulay Avenue one day headed home from work. And I passed by this place called D&W Glass Shop, and they were building aquariums in there. And I thought, how intriguing is that? So I wandered in there and was just talking to him, and the guy was cutting glass to build this. It was a grandfather clock made of solid glass, and it was an aquarium with a moving pendulum on the inside. I was totally intrigued by the art. You know, I was like, how do you do that? And he showed me with a glass cutter how to cut glass. Now, my favorite thing in a nightclub is the mirror ball. I have always been attracted to the look of a mirror ball because it's just screen 70s, and I just love what they look like. They're so pretty. So I got it in my head, if I buy those 12 by 12 mirror tiles from Walmart, I can cut those things up into 1/8-inch squares, and I made a costume out of solid mirrors. When I popped out on that stage, it stung the children. They went nuts. I was like, are you serious? Are you serious? Are you freaking serious? Are you serious right now? Because the bar was smoky, and all you saw was these beams of light going everywhere from all these mirrors. And I was like, the kids were going up for me. And I was like, wow, they like what I did. So I got this fever. It fed my ego in the worst way. I was like, I got to do some more. So I got myself good and drunk, and I thought, what am I going to do next, you know? So I got some pantyhose and some duct tape. Now, that sounds scary, but let me tell you what I got in my head. Because I see things that a lot of people don't see when it comes to like art and molding and sculpting. And I thought, if I put that pantyhose on my head and I wrap my head with duct tape really tight, I can make a skull cap that fits my head. And then from that skull cap, I can build things and go up from there. And I started with a small feather headdress because I really love Vegas costumes and stuff, right? So I started making costumes. And every time I made something, I had to outdo what I did before. Let me tell you, that mirror costume was hard to outdo, but I managed to do it. And so it eventually, fast forward, came to a point to where I had quite the career in costume designing and was given special guest positions at nightclubs all the way from Chicago down to Pensacola, Florida. I was traveling, doing drag shows and pageants and stuff. It was a lot of fun. No shortage of drinking because the nightclub owners always bought you drinks and they're always free. So, hell yeah, free, 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 you know. And then in the dressing room, there's always cocaine and there's always meth, right? So, these are the outside issues. This would be a little difficult for me to talk about, but it's absolutely chaotic. In the dressing rooms was the first time I had witnessed cocaine. And you know, everybody in the room was doing it, but I had never tried it before. I was always like, that's taboo, my God, you know. But they're like, come on, dude, it'll make you feel like Superman or Superwoman, whatever your choice is, right? So eventually, of course, because everybody else was doing it, I did it. And she wasn't kidding. I was ready to soar on that cloud nine, right? Boom. And it was really awesome, and I loved it, and I did it repeatedly, and I drank on top of it. I drank a lot of liquor, and I did cocaine. And the weird thing about it was, I'll tell you the effect of that in a few minutes. But, yeah, I was out of control with that. But when you drink alcohol, it's a depressant. It suppresses your immune or your energy. When you do cocaine, it raises it up. So I was on this roller coaster that went up and down. You know, the cocaine would get me jacked up, but after a while, the alcohol would bring me down. So I'd have to do more cocaine to get blah, 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 on and on. So eventually it got to where, like, you know, where they say alcohol just doesn't work anymore, you know, because you've just done it for so many years it don't work. Cocaine's the same way. Eventually it just became so mild that it just didn't do anything. So when I moved to Atlanta, I joined Charlie Brown's Cabaret at Backstreet. Atlanta, of course, we know is huge for their drug cartel, right? So that's when I got into methamphetamine, and alcohol was still always a part of it. It was actually the major root of everything. So Backstreet is a 24-hour Metroplex that was on Peachtree Street. And sometimes I would party in there for like 4 days at a time without showering, without brushing my teeth, without stopping. Because I would do meth all during the evening and drink on top of it. And again, here's your psych up from the meth, and then you're crashed down when it starts to wear off and the alcohol gets you. Then you got to do more meth, and it goes up and down and up and down. Days go by, and finally, your pockets are empty. Your drink is empty, and you don't have any more money, and you're still racing. You don't want to go home. You just don't want to go home, but you don't have anything left to spend. So you wander around for a couple of hours, and eventually you have to give up and go home. So nothing is more frightening than when you go downstairs to the front entrance and you open up the doors to go outside and this bright sun that you haven't seen in like 4 days hits you in the face and the heat of the outside air hits you and you have to get in your car and drive home completely screwed up, right? So I get home and I'm laying there trying to go to sleep, and eventually I was able to eat a little something and go to sleep. Well, it got to where my habits were so demanding of me that I started stealing from the club I was working at. I was, on the nights that I didn't do drag shows, I was working at the front desk and I was collecting admissions to get into the club. But I was pocketing a bunch of it and they caught me on pinhole camera. So they came and pulled me into the office and said, you know, we're going to have to let you go. So I thought, well, I won't be able to work the front door anymore. No big deal. They said, no, you don't understand. You need to go upstairs to that dressing room and clean out all your costumes. You're finished in this club. I thought the carpet then yanked out from under me because it just didn't occur to me that they were going to take it all away. But why wouldn't they? It was the same club, just a different show, right? So, so I got myself home and stayed drunk for a couple of days trying to process the whole thing because everything that I had ever wanted was just gone at that point. So I just drank and drank and it was terrible. And then I finally got off my feet and I thought, I want to go out and party somewhere. I've got to do something. So this is where the weird part comes in. There is, is anybody in, or are most of you in here familiar with what a bathhouse is? Okay. It was big in the 70s. Well, there happens to be one in Atlanta that I applied for a job at. So, very interesting. I went to work at this bathhouse. They have a bar and they have a large clientele. And if you're not familiar with it, it's a gay men's clothing optional facility is what it is. And I was in charge of admissions at the door. Yeah. Very strange. This kid's in radical shit, okay? So I'm working there and there's a lot of meth going around in there and a lot of alcohol and stuff. And of course I'm into it all and everything. And as I'm going home at night, I'm trying to sleep. I sleep for like 10, 12 hours, but when I wake up, I'm in a puddle of sweat, very thick sweat, you know. So I was like, God, these drugs are really doing a number on me, so I'm going to cut that out. So, you know, I just laid off the drugs for a while, but I continued to drink. So alcohol is starting to take over 100% now, so I'm drinking constantly. But I'm starting to lose a lot of weight, and I'm still waking up in these puddles of sweats, and then I had some other problems that we won't go into that, you know, that occurred while I was sleeping that I had no control over, and I was getting sicker and sicker. And I thought, geez, you know, all those drugs I did, I've done a number of myself. I need to go to the doctor and just be honest. So I went to the doctor, and they examined me and, you know, took blood tests and see if everything was okay or whatever, and said you need to come back in 2 weeks. And I'm thinking, 2 weeks, you know, whatever. So I went home, and, you know, I still drank, didn't think nothing of it. And I went back 2 weeks later, and the nurse came in with the paperwork. And I said, so what's the op, doc? She's like, well, Mr. Taylor, are you taking your medicine? I said, well, I hadn't been prescribed any yet. She goes, you need to be taking your medicine. I said, I haven't been given any. She goes, would you excuse me for a moment? I said, yeah, sure. So she went out, and then the male doctor came in. And he said, Mr. Taylor, do you have any idea what was just said to you? And I said, she didn't say anything. He said, Mr. Taylor, you are HIV positive. That long period of silence that I just presented to you was exactly what happened in my room. I felt like death was upon me. I felt like that's it. It's done. It's done. This is 1996, right? And I'd heard about Ryan White, and I'd heard about the AIDS epidemic, but I didn't set out to do that. I didn't sign up for this. You know, I was just having a good time. I didn't mean for anybody to hurt me, and I didn't mean to hurt anybody else. But he said, you are definitely positive. And I said, yes, sir, I understand, sir. I said, how much time do I have? He goes, well, I don't know. We're going to have to run some more tests. Can you think of anything else to say besides, I don't know, we're going to have to run more tests, because I'm already thinking it's the end. But so he runs some more tests on me, and he said, we're going to have to start you on some antiretrovirals. They're very expensive. They're about $3,000 a month after your insurance covers them. I'm out of a job. I don't have any way, so I'm thinking I'm dead. I'm just dead. So I just stayed home, and I just stayed drunk constantly, because I thought, what's the use? My life is over. I'm gone anyway. But then this clinical trial I had read about opened up. 13 people from across the nation were invited to join this clinical trial at the Centers for Disease Control. And they asked me if I wanted to be one of the people in the clinical trial. I said, well, sure, you know, because I thought to myself, well, I may as well do something for science because I can't afford these medications. They said, your medications will be free to you, but we have to test them before the FDA will approve them. So I thought, well, I don't have another shot, so I may as well do that. So they put me on 4 antiretrovirals and reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And after about a month and a half, they took one of them off of my regimen because it was causing liver damage. But the other 3 were approved by the FDA, still used to this day. So for the rest of my life, because of that clinical trial, I am provided medication by the CDC. And it was just, it was incredible. But I still didn't stop drinking. You know, it still didn't occur to me that alcohol was damaging me. But I have to run back the one thing that got me to stop doing drugs. And this is a really touching story. And it's hard for me to talk about it. But it's experience. I had been up for like 3 days and I was soldering some jewelry. I used to make jewelry also for stage. And I was soldering some rhinestones and making jewelry. And I was sitting at my dresser with this big mirror in front of me, and I had a marble block because they won't transmit heat, and I was soldering. Long, long times go by, and I'm just doing a little bit here and keeping on there and a little bit more keeping on there and staying drunk and everything. And as I'm sitting there, I'm getting really tired because so much time has caught up with me. And I just did like this, and I looked up in the mirror, and in the reflection of the mirror are my 2 little dogs, my 2 little babies. I had a miniature pincher and a little pug, both of their noses sticking out from under the blanket. I had not seen them. I had not touched them. I had not walked them. I had not fed or watered them in almost 4 days. The thing I cannot stress enough is how that sound was when I filled the water dish and both of them jumped that and lap, 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 lap. I just went to pieces and cried my little eyes out because these 2 little angels that I've had from the time they were born were sitting there looking at me for all those days, just wondering, when is Daddy going to take me outside? The carpet was urinated completely because I had just neglected my dogs. It was all about me and all about this stuff that I wanted to do. So that was my last experience with drugs, and I almost forgot about that thing, but it was something that touched me, because they're like your babies, they're like your children, they're helpless, you know, and I cannot live that down to this day that I did that to those babies. But I had them for 15 years, and after I straightened up, I took care of those things like princesses. They were better than I was. They dressed better than I did when I was on stage, right? You can just imagine. But anyway, yeah. So we've gone through the alcohol, the meth, the up and down. My experience when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, here we go. Time to raise the roof, right? Woo! Thank you, Lord. Thank you. Okay. So I had gotten to a point after so many years of drinking that my doctor, who was watching over me with my HIV problems and stuff, had been working and working and working, trying to get my HIV under control. Did everything he possibly could. But he kept on telling me, Cliff, your liver enzymes are extremely high. How much are you drinking? Oh, just a couple of beers, maybe a cocktail now and then. Who's going to tell their doctor the truth? Because you know he's going to tell you to stop, and you ain't taking my drink away from me. Uh-uh. So he stayed after my butt for that for a long time, and I continued getting worse with my immune system, and I developed pneumonia. Pneumocystis pneumonia is the number one killer of people with HIV, and my lungs were flooded with it. And because of that, I had no circulation to my legs. And as a result, for those of you that might remember me when I first came in, I had open sores all over my arms and all over my legs. When I came into the program, it was in August, and it was hotter than 450 hells outside. Was, right? But my dress code was a long-sleeve sweatshirt with a hood and a pair of fingerless gloves that are made for stress on your hands. And people would ask me, what are the gloves about? And I'd say, I have carpal tunnel syndrome. I just tried to cover it up. But the thing was, I was covered with open sores on both of my hands, and my skin was barely hanging onto my bones because of how the toxicity of what my liver was not filtering out was running rampant through my system. And my skin was literally rotting off my flesh, and I was down to 97 pounds. And so I went to my boss at work, and I said, Lenny, I've been with him for about 7 years, almost 8 years. And I said, Lenny, I know I'm in your management position, and I know you need me, but I said, I've got to tell you something that nobody knows. I said, I've got a bad drinking problem. He just looked at me and goes, Cliff, everybody knows you've got a bad drinking problem. I'm thinking, how is that? He goes, how do you expect them not to know? You stink of it all damn day. And I'm sitting there thinking, if I tell him this, he's going to fire me, but he already knew about it. But he's got such a heart to help people, he wasn't going to fire me. And plus, I really do a good job, but it was eventually getting to the point to where I was not able to function. I was a substandard employee, and I was not doing what I was being paid for. So I asked him if I could have time off to go to treatment, and he says, well, you've got vacation hours. But I had used all of my vacation hours up, calling out sick, going home early, because I was desperate to get home and have another drink. I had to have another drink. I was at the point to where I could get through 4 hours of work before this would start happening. And I was trembling and shaking. And we have these handheld things that, you know, they scan with, like at Home Depot and stuff. They scan barcodes or whatever. And you're supposed to sign in with your username and password. But I was shaking so hard I couldn't sign in. I would have other people sign in and give them my password to sign in. So it eventually got to the point where I had to go to treatment. And I went to Ridgeview. And I was only in detox for 4 days. Now, everybody else I know had aftercare or sober living facility or other program stuff, and they highly recommended that I go to one. But I couldn't do it. I said, I can't do it. I have no hours left. My boss is already paying for my hours to come here, and I have to pay him back. And my friend Joyce is already funding me to come to Ridgeview, and I have to pay her back, which both are paid back thanks to Step 9. Trust, yeah. So I got through the detox, and I came back to work, and many of the people that I worked with were very intolerant of my presence because I had done so much damage, and I smelled so bad, and I pissed so many people off because I was hardly doing my job, and everybody was having to pick up my slack because my boss wouldn't fire me. All they wanted was me out of there. The other employees did, but the management staff was like, no, we can't do that. He needs help. So I got back out of detox. And I came to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and it was really funny. I got the welcome package with everybody's phone number on it, right? So I'm thinking, okay, I'm out of detox. I'm cool. The first thing I did when I walked in from Ridgeview was I went straight for the vodka and cranberry juice. I said, after all the shit I've been through, I need a drink. What I went to Ridgeview for was not to quit drinking and to get sober. I went there to learn how to drink like a normal person because I am so naive. I had no idea that this was a program to stop you from drinking altogether and to get your life together. So here I'm living with this other roommate. Her name is Melanie, and she was really drunk with me all the time. We used to fight constantly. And I'm sitting on the couch, and I'm going down having my cocktail, and I'm going down this list of names on the AA welcome packet, calling people. I'm like, yeah, girl, Alcoholics Anonymous is just really awesome. The people are so great, and I just love these meetings. It's so good. Yes, I feel so good. God is with me, and da-da-da. So here comes Melanie out the bedroom, drunk as a skunk. And she goes, you need to stop lying to those people. And I'm covering up the phone going, shut up. He's like, what are you doing telling all these people all these lies for? I was like, Melanie, you need to shut up because you're drunk. And she looked at me and she goes, you know what? I might be drunk, but you're a freaking hypocrite. She stabbed me with the worst weapon you could possibly pull on me. I was like, oh my gosh, she just got the upper hand because she was telling the absolute truth. So after hanging up that phone, I decided to go to Cornerstone in Kennesaw. That was my first meeting after my first relapse. I only relapsed one day. And I met some extraordinary people there, one of which came up to me, and because I was sitting by myself and I was terrified. She came up to me and she says, you don't know who I am, but I remember who you are. And I thought, oh my God, do I owe this bitch money or something? What do you want? She goes, my name is Stacy. She said, I was with the, what do you call them? The group that comes, the alumni. I was with a group of alumni and I came to Ridgeview and I saw you so scared and so sick. And she goes, I just want you to know that I remember who you are and you can be my friend and I'll help you out. Oh, I just wanted to hug her and never let her go because I was so scared about being in there. I thought, what a glum lot, you know, just like they say, we're not a glum lot. Of course, we all think it's going to be that when we first come here. So I was withdrawn from everybody from the beginning, but she made me feel welcome and at home and introduced me to a lot of extraordinary people. And that was my home group for about a year and a half. And after that first couple of days in that program, I met Kevin, my sponsor. And what a tremendous man he is. And I said, well, how long have you been sober? And he says, well, I did have 12 years, but on New Year's Eve, year 2000, I went back out. Now I've got 15 years. Neither one is conscionable to me. I'm like, how does anybody get 10 years? That's just not possible, dude. I've got 24 hours. What are you talking about? And he said, well, you know, it can happen to the best of us if you let your guard down. So I was like, will you be my sponsor? He goes, I'm already your sponsor. You just don't know yet. And I'm like, okay. So I said, okay, sir, what do you like me to do? He says, well, do you think you can go without drinking for 24 hours? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I certainly hope so because you didn't do it yesterday. Called me out on my shit, right? I'm like, oh, my God, you know. But he has turned out to be, like, one of the best friends I've ever had, and he's very supportive of me. I wish he could be here tonight, but he's on the road traveling. But I promised him I was going to be his ideal sponsor. I was going to stick with this program. But right now, let's see what this thing has to say. First of all, the time. Security. Security! There we go. I forgot I have one of these, too. Cool. So yeah, this program has just rewarded me with so many things because coming in here, 97-pound weakling, thoroughly sick, totally infected, top to bottom, can hardly walk, absolutely no credit, absolutely nothing worthwhile whatsoever, no friends, nothing but mistrust from everybody who knows me, except one lady that I work with. Her name is Joyce, and Joyce and I both started at Joanne Fabric at the same time, and she said, if you really want help, Cliff, honey, I'll pay for it. She goes, you just make arrangements to pay me back when you can. So I'm thinking, you know, I don't know her from Adam, you know, but except, you know, just at the job, but she's offering, because that's an expensive little treatment, you know. Just my part without insurance was $5,000. So she paid for me to go to that treatment center, and I've since completely paid her back, and we've become like this. And she's like my recovery warrior. She's ready to whoop my butt if I make a mistake. And she's Scottish-Irish, if that tells you anything about her. Nope. And she's from Chicago, too, so she has a little bit of street cred as well. But I'll tell you, as per our 11th tradition, our public relations policy is built on attraction rather than promotion. And I'm here to say, if you don't find spiritual healing, bodily healing, financial responsibility, and a host of friends to be attractive, then honey, I don't understand you at all. Because this program has given me back 1,000 times what I came in here for. I did not come in here to get better. I just didn't want to get any worse. Boy, was I in for a surprise. I'm telling you. I could barely walk when I got here. Now I can jog all the way to Texas and back. Still magnolias, right? I'm like, jog again. No. It's just, I was nervous and terrified when I first came in here tonight because I was like, oh my God, I'm going to talk for an hour. But it just occurred to me, and so many people reminded me, you're standing in front of your own family. You know, they're not going to judge you for anything. And all of you people are what I used to call, and I used to say it in a negative way, normal people. You know, I don't want to be around normal people. But it's funny, it's what I've always prayed for. It's the acceptance by normal society that I've always wanted, and I always felt rejected as a child. But it's amazing at my age what I have seen the world change from the early 80s when it was very taboo and you'd be beaten half to death for being an admitted, quote, what they called fag, into people who don't even look at you that way anymore. They just look at you as Cliff, and I feel like part of the family. So now that I put all that crap aside and I don't have to worry about that stuff anymore because you people afforded me that ability to do that, I can focus on my recovery. Okay, my recovery, I believe, with God's help, is set in stone, and I'm very confident where I'm at right now. So now my main thing is, oh my God, every person on planet Earth should have the opportunity to feel the way that I feel right now, because, girl, let this shirt represent the cloud that I am currently surfing, right? It is pink. And it does not stop. Every time I think I've had just about as much as I can take, more negativity is pulled out of me when I pray it away, and it opens up room for so much more to keep pouring in. And every time I think I'm at the peak and I'm just going to explode, I have to make room to handle more, because there's so many people out there that need it. And I've more or less gotten rid of the notes like Doug Mefford told me to do. Because some other extraordinary things have happened to me. I've had HIV for 22 years. And I've never given back to that community. And if you notice, as opposed to the 80s, education and talk about HIV transmission has really dwindled in the past 10 years. You just don't hear about it much anymore. However, it is spreading like wildfire. So my dream at this moment is to become a circuit speaker for Alcoholics Anonymous, to go around the country and spread my message of hope and love and strength and courage and recovery to people suffering from alcohol and addiction, because I have experience with both. But I also got an email from a professor at Kennesaw State University who has asked me to come in May to speak at the college on living with HIV and the prevention and the education of the transmission of the virus, because I have a lot of experience with that. So now I have two duties that I have to repay. And General Lee himself once said that duty was the most beautiful word in the English language. I think he wrote, "I slept and dreamt that life was beauty. I woke to find that life was duty." It's a wonderful thing, and I have a duty nowadays, or I have a duty, an obligation and a duty from God to get out there and grab as many people as I can and help them, because it really helps me with my own recovery. I get this power and this energy from it, not because they've done anything physically for me, but because I'm worth something. Somebody needs my help. Somebody's taking something that I've said, and they're actually using my experience to better their own life. And how does that happen when I thought I was such a low life for so many years and I really thought I wasn't worth anything? But God has convinced me that I am absolutely worth everything. You are absolutely worth everything. Because the very reason that I stand here, happy, joyous, free, and alive, is because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the education in this program, the 12 steps, and my higher power. And with that, I'm going to tell you one final thing. Well, I guess I'm not. Yes, I am. No, it was something that I read on a post that I thought was really cute. Let's see. Get out of there. Let's see. Security, you got to go through. I like the weird people. I like weird people. The black sheep, the eight balls, the left centers, the wallflowers, the underdog, the loners, the rejects, the outcast, the outsiders, the odd ducks, the eccentric, the broken, the lonely, the lost, and the forgotten. Many of us have been through that thing, but those are the people that are like the lotus flower. The lotus is one of the most beautiful flowers in the world, but it blooms brightly in the thickest of mud that there is. Every one of you are lotus flowers, and thank you so much for having me here tonight.